broadcasting on the Drug Truth Network, this is Cultural Baggage.
It's not only inhumane, it is really fundamentally un-American.
My name is Dean Becker. I don't condone or encourage the use of any drugs, legal or illegal. I report the unvarnished truth about the pharmaceutical, banking, prison, and judicial nightmare that feeds on eternal drug war.
Welcome to this edition of Cultural Baggage. First up, I want to thank those who sent flowers and condolences for the recent passing of my mother, Dorothy Obrecht. We will certainly miss her, and your concerns are much appreciated. Our next show will feature Dr. Robert Melamed, and we'll discuss how medicinal cannabis might have helped my mother following her stroke. We go from sorrow to joy. Seems how life works, I guess. Houston's Pacifica station, KPFT, has given the go-ahead for another half hour of programming each week for the Drug Truth Network. We're now up to 33 affiliate stations in the U.S. and Canada. We're moving to prime time as well in the Houston and Galveston markets. We now have the full hour from 7 p.m. to 8 p.m. Central Time on Fridays to present the unvarnished truth about the drug war. From 7 p.m. to 7:30 on Fridays, Cultural Baggage will continue as the clubhouse of all reform, showcase the latest scientific evidence, the most compelling writers, the stories of abuse, fraud, and corruption that make the drug war so successful. From 7:30 to 8 p.m. on Fridays, our new baby, Century of Lies, will pick up a sledgehammer and drive home the point that the drug war is totally unworkable. Guests will include judges, wardens, cops, prosecutors, and those that were almost ground up in the eternal abuses of prohibition. We'll be doing segments, law enforcement against prohibition. Saul turns to Paul. Name that jurisdiction by its drug laws. And Winston Francis will move his shtick to Century of Lies with the official government truth. We will call for an immediate redirection of our policies, a reach towards sanity and fiscal responsibility in regards to the whole of the drug war. We had an event over the weekend here, the 420 Fest, and we were able to, it was a rousing success, a beautiful day, and I have here in the studio with me the producer, Mr. Randy Wall.
Hey, this is Randy. I just wanted to stop by and say thanks to all the bands, speakers, Ed Rosenthal and Mr. Dean Becker, and of course the Last Concert Cafe for a job well done. We set a new record, we raised a lot of money for Normal, and we're excited about the things to come.
I want to thank Randy and Third Ward Productions for all their wonderful work in making this happen. Let's see. We do have our guest online, I believe, or perhaps not. Yes. I wanted to give you a little segment from the 420 Fest. This is Mr. Ed Rosenthal.
And here to give us some feedback, some information, some guidance, and a push is our good friend from Oaksterdam, Oakland, California, Mr. Ed Rosenthal.
Happy 420. These laws are doomed. Now, over the weekend, Dean and I have developed some strategies for getting these laws changed and the enforcement of these laws changed. And now's not the time to talk about them. But I know that Dean is going to want your help in it. I'm helping Dean. I came all the way from Oaksterdam, Oakland, California, and I want to tell you that there are 30 medical marijuana facilities in San Francisco. You cross the bridge into Oakland, there are four. You go a little bit north, next to the city next to it is Berkeley, there are three. The county of Alameda, which includes Oakland, has seven other dispensaries. There are more than 100 dispensaries throughout California, all over West Hollywood and Sacramento, everywhere, Northern California, Southern California. It is happening in California. Medical marijuana is being distributed to thousands of people every day, tens of thousands of people. And it will happen here. It's not, it can happen here. It will happen here.
And indeed it will happen, my friends, when you decide that it's time. You know, when you stand up and you write those letters and make those calls and visit those congressmen. Okay, I'm told that we do now have online our guest for the evening, and I'm proud to have him with us. He's a Canadian barrister, Mr. Alan Young.
Good evening.
Yes, sir. Tell the folks a bit about yourself and perhaps your involvement with the medical marijuana situation in Canada.
Okay, well, I'm a law professor. I specialize in criminal law, and I do civil rights work. I originally got into the pot issue as a general liberty issue dealing with consensual crimes, and in the mid-90s we challenged the constitutionality of our marijuana possession offense, and we lost. They upheld the law, it was a long battle, but in the course of studying recreational use and advocating on its behalf, medical users came to me, and I discovered something that's existed for thousands of years, which is that cannabis sativa has great therapeutic value. We may not know exactly why. It's actually pretty complicated. So as a result, and sort of an offshoot of our constitutional challenges, we brought other court cases to establish a constitutional right to choose a medicine that works for you, and for some people that was medicinal marijuana. And to make a long story short, because it is a long story, ultimately the government was compelled to establish a program to exempt people from our criminal law if they need to use marijuana. And I think we have about 900 people in the program, which is really just the tip of the iceberg. I mean, most people don't really want to apply to the program, but I guess internationally it looks as if we move much further than most nations.
Now, Mr. Young, the thing that I find interesting, yes, Canada's a large country. How many million people?
About 30.
30 million people, but yet 900. I mean, that's a goodly number, but there are considerably more people who could benefit from medical marijuana,
well,
am I right?
You know, the Canadian Medical Association came up with a pretty bizarre number. I really don't know how they did their accounting, very favorable for our movement, which is they said there's 400,000 marijuana users who are using it for medical purposes, which is a huge amount. And of course, if that's true, then obviously the 900, as I said, is the tip of the iceberg, and it reflects the fact that the government actually came to the program kind of kicking and screaming. It wasn't something they voluntarily chose to do. It was really as a result of court orders. So I've always taken the position over the evolution of the last 5 years that they've taken a lot of steps that are obstacles to prevent the program from flourishing, but I still have to applaud them for at least setting up a program. But yes, it's only serving the interest of a very small amount of people. For example, in Toronto, which is, I guess, about 3 million people, we have two major compassion clubs, and they're servicing somewhere in around 4,000 or 5,000 people. So obviously the underground is doing the job the government wants to do but can't quite get it right.
I understand that in Canada you have a separate set of laws, a filter, if you will, that further protects the rights of your people, the human rights consideration, if you will, that doesn't, I guess, enter the picture here in the U.S. Talk about that, if you will.
Well, not really. I mean, quite frankly, we have very similar legal regimes, and there isn't much in human rights law per se. This is all about the Constitution, which obviously your Constitution has existed far longer than ours. And it's the interpretation of your due process clause, your Fifth Amendment. We do it under something called fundamental justice. And we've been able to maybe convince the courts of greater liberty issues in relation to marijuana, though I know there's a couple cases going up to your U.S. Supreme Court that may open the door somewhat if they see it as a constitutional right. So it isn't really so much that we have different systems. It's just, I'll say for the time being, our courts be more generous in its interpretation of the Constitution, more like your Supreme Court was in the late 60s.
Now, you bring up these cases that are currently in the U.S. Headed to the Supreme Court, Angel Reese versus Ashcroft, or I guess the Justice Department at this point.
Mm-hmm.
The big concern at this point is that the Supreme Court may rule in favor of interstate commerce over the rights of this frail young woman and her need for medical marijuana. Your thoughts there, sir?
Well, I mean, I'm not an expert in American constitutional law, though I do have an American law degree also. I think that's a very plausible scenario, and I don't really know the current makeup of your court to know whether it's very federalist in nature. That would be unfortunate, but I think it's a very neutral, easy way for them to to duck the issue, basically, and just throw it back to the feds, and we know what their position is on this, unfortunately.
Yes, sir. There was an article you did in Now Magazine, and I'm not asking you to recreate it here, but it talked about the hypocrisy of this whole thing, the fact that we're so worried about people using medical marijuana, yet we allow kids to die sometimes playing hockey.
Well, yeah. Well, I mean, I did compare the risk factor of medicinal marijuana to current pharmaceuticals, and we all know how many have been pulled off the shelves lately in North America. There's a lot of very dangerous pharmaceuticals. The side effects from marijuana are very meek, which is one of the reasons why we promote legalization, is because the harms are very minimal. What we need to find out in terms of the medicine is why it's effective. I think we know it's safe, and knowing it's safe is a reason to legalize it for recreational use and to start doing the research to find out why it's effective medicinally.
Now, as I understand it, in Canada there are untold numbers of grow rooms, sometimes controlled by gangs, and I wonder what your thoughts, sir. There's talk of decrim versus.
Here's the interesting thing going on in Canada. I mean, our government talks about decriminalizing marijuana use, and as soon as they started to talk about that, they started to demonize the grow, the supply side of it. Now, the reality is that, sure, there is a little bit of organized crime infiltration in the marijuana trade. It's an illicit contraband product. But quite frankly, it's quite muted, organized crime. There's not a great profit margin in marijuana. And so it's not really a very dangerous occupation. But the police have managed to paint a picture of all these biblical plagues, houses burning down, mold growing on the ceiling, and things of that nature. And by the way, it has happened. I've had clients who have had, because of faulty wiring, a house burned down. I mean, there are tragedies that happen, largely because it's in a black market. I mean, no one has a great incentive to work with occupational health and safety codes because you don't want to be detected. And so we've created a bit of a problem, and then, of course, what the state does, and the U.S. government does this all the time, they blow it out of proportion, they create a mountain out of a molehill. And so what's happening is there's this delicate tension in Canada where Canadians are confused. They thought, oh, marijuana is pretty harmless. We're going to decriminalize it. Oh, but people growing it are horrible people, and they're endangering our communities. And it's just really confusing the issue. And quite frankly, Canada is stalled right now on the path to law reform because of that attempt to simultaneously demonize and decriminalize. It's a very difficult thing to do, and governments are doing it all over. I mean, even all the European countries that have decriminalized, no one comes out and says marijuana is good. They're afraid to say that, and that's the hypocrisy I speak of. No one really wants to speak the truth. I'm not saying it's for everybody, and I'm not advocating its use for everyone. I think, you know, people have to learn responsible drug use as adults, but in any event, that's the problem. There's a lot of very strange double messages that occur when it comes to our drug laws, because I think we're very confused about whether we want people to have a right to be intoxicated or not. Is that really the right, the pursuit of happiness? You know, that's the question.
Absolutely right. I mean, to reach back a moment there to the thought that it is this black market that creates the problems with the grow houses, it's also the reason that children have easy access to marijuana as well.
Well, children have easy access to marijuana largely because it's the most commonly used illicit drug in the world. I mean, that's something that's forgotten. And, I mean, the estimates, and I don't know how these figures are arrived at, is there's 250 million people who smoke marijuana. And that's a vast amount. And so it's just very common in the Western world, especially now. And it's unfortunate that, I don't know how you define child, but if we're talking about under 16, it's unfortunate that there is such easy access, because I really do believe that people have to develop a certain maturity before they can experiment with alternative realities, not to make it sound too dramatic. But that's one of the unfortunate things, and that's one of the things that happens when you prohibit something and you don't regulate it. It's a lot easier to control the activities of youth through a regulated market, though I'm not naive. I realize that many people drink underage, and that's sort of a rite of passage.
If you could come up with a solution, is it decrim? Is it legalized for adults? How would you make the change?
Okay. There's no question in my mind that the only rational solution is a fully legalized market, carefully regulated, to minimize the small risks that are involved. Now, having said that, I'm also a realist. And I realize that the Western world is not prepared for that outright statement, which seems like a statement of approval, and they're also going to claim that there are international treaties that prevent them from doing it. So, on the path towards a rational policy, the only step we can take is decriminalization, which is, to me, the no-brainer issue, which is remove the criminal law from marijuana use. This is not robbery. This is not sexual assault. This is not destroying the fabric of any nation. You use criminal law for serious predatory crime. So that's what decriminalization means. Move it out of penal codes. If you want to prohibit it as a civil wrong and ticket people, I'm not happy with that, but I would prefer to live in a regime that doesn't criminalize minor choices, lifestyle choices. If they want to fine it, go ahead. So ultimately, as I said, the only rational policy is legalization, but right now the Western world will have to content themselves with decriminalization, which is what the Western world is doing outside of North America. We're behind the times, quite frankly, and most of Europe is decriminalized, most of Australia is decriminalized. England has flirted with something they call declassification. So the whole world's turning. We're coming close. The United States is light years behind.
Now, you mentioned earlier that Canada is stalled in their law crafting, if you will. Is there any impetus? Do you see any direction it's going to take?
Well, I got to tell you, I'm not a real political beast. I'm a legal person. But right now in Canada, unfortunately, I have to tell you, there's a bit of a scandal going on with our government in terms of a corruption issue. And there may be an election coming up shortly. And the reason I mention this is because they have tabled a decriminalization bill. It's a little bit flawed. It doesn't go all the way. The criminal law is kind of still looming in the background. But what I'm trying to say is it is a matter of some controversy, even though I don't think it should be. And this government's not going to be able to pass it when they're facing this major corruption scandal at this moment. So it's kind of back burner, and that's being the path of law reform in North America. We've all come close. You've had many states that have decriminalized and many more that proposed it in the 70s. People come close in North America to actually changing the law. We just haven't seen it yet. So I can't give you a prognosis for the future. I do know that the medical marijuana program in Canada will not be rescinded because it's under court order, quite frankly. So that will continue to flourish. I know that there's interest in Canada in the development of cannabis medicines, and some companies are jumping into the fray to do the research. So in terms of medical marijuana, I think Canada will move forward fairly rapidly. But in terms of recreational use, I have a feeling we'll be having the same interview and discussion in 5-10 years.
Now, we've only got a little bit of time left. I wanted to ask you, here in the U.S., the Drug Czar's latest campaign is to say that marijuana is twice as powerful as it was before. They even have a photo ads these days with a hand holding two joints.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking that really should be half a joint. But do they have that propaganda war up there as well?
Well, of course we do, and that's what the prohibitionists who still have a voice here in Canada hold on to. They wait for the propaganda to emanate from south of the border. I don't want to sound like a disrespectful Canadian. I have great respect for the United States of America, but on certain issues, you distort reality to such a degree, it's a disgrace. And the propaganda about most drugs has come from your jurisdiction. And we buy into some of it, and it's been what stalled us a little bit. Your propaganda is more muted across the Atlantic Ocean for obvious reasons, but it does have more impact here. We share a lot of cultural, political, and legal values together. So it's been a bit of a problem, and it saddens me that governments use science as a tool of propaganda, faulty science. It really distorts the purity of science. No, marijuana, yeah, maybe it's a bit more potent than it used to be. I really don't know that. I've seen some of the statistics, but everybody who thinks about it logically knows if it's not harmful, per se, a higher dose, we'll say, just means you will smoke less. So quite frankly, it's a good thing that marijuana is more potent, because the only thing that is risky is there's pulmonary risk because you're smoking. So if you smoke less, that's a good thing.
Well, Well, I think we'll have to leave it with that for this time. We've been speaking with Alan Young, a Canadian barrister, and a great guest. I appreciate you being with us.
My pleasure. Thanks.
Thank you, sir.
It's time to play Name That Drug by Its Side Effects. Euphoria thwarts prostate cancer, stops hardening of the arteries, prevents heart disease, provides relief to AIDS patients, revitalizes anorexics, provides mobility and ends spasticity for MS sufferers, and prevents brain swelling following a stroke. Time's up. The answer, an herb of the field. See Genesis chapter 1. Marijuana, cannabis, cannablossom. Not approved by the FDA.
The Justice Department announced Sunday that the U.S. has a record high number of its citizens behind bars. Why is it we still don't feel safe? Prisons and jails are seriously overcrowded around the country. This comes as no shock to listeners of the Drug Truth Network. Drug arrests are at all-time highs, even though low-price, high-purity cocaine and heroin are as widely available as ever. Meanwhile, crank has outmuscled crack. Methamphetamine has become the new drug scare of choice as use and domestic production of the stuff has risen dramatically over the past decade. We're told that the growing prison population is a good thing. After all, we have had record low crime rates. Yet research shows that it's the economy, not the incarceration rate, which has been responsible for that. And those happy days are coming to an end. The Justice Department also reports that our 30-year decline in the crime rate has leveled off. Research conducted by the UK government shows that the homicide rate in the U.S. is the third highest in the world. Other research, also from the UK government, reveals that the U.S. has the world's highest rate of incarceration. Coincidence? I doubt it. For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh, editor of DrugWarFacts.org.
Let's take a look back at the tragic events of March 21st, 2005. A young student in Red Lake, Minnesota. A school shooting. A suicide. 24 victims, 10 fatalities. But what set Jeff Weiss off? The trials and tribulations of his own life? Or was it something else? After all, scenes such as this one were not uncommon at Red Lake. In fact, the Justice Department launched a major crackdown on drugs and guns on the reservation, citing evidence of executions, drive-bys, and ritualistic violence. And then again, in January 2004, locals raked police buildings with gunfire, prompting a crackdown by the FBI and ATF. So the reservation had seen this kind of violence before. But what is it about Red Lake? Well, Bill Blake, a veteran of the Minneapolis Police Department, said that gang members operate a drug pipeline that floods Red Lake with marijuana and other illegal narcotics. In fact, according to the results of a 2004 survey, more than half of the Red Lake students used marijuana, and a staggering 81% of the females admitted to contemplating or attempting suicide. And now even the BBC admits that smoking cannabis virtually doubles the risk of developing mental illnesses such as schizophrenia in an article headlined, "Drug Doubles Mental Health Risk," on March 1st, 2005. How much evidence do you need? Marijuana is an addictive drug, which produces in its users insanity, criminality, and death. This has been Winston Francis with the official Government Truth.
And now another black perspective on the drug war. As a black man in America, whose eyes have been opened, I can clearly see the irony in the fact that black Americans are stronger supporters of the so-called war on drugs than white Americans. An understandable reaction, perhaps, when their communities are the scenes of drive-by shootings by well-armed street gangs, filthy crack houses and shooting galleries, crack whores and muggers roaming the streets, schoolyard dope dealers, and coming home from work to find that your drug-addicted child or spouse has stolen everything from the ceiling fan to the carpets on the floor for just a few dollars worth of drugs. I know a very nice couple who drop by regularly, like the suburban Avon lady or the Amway rep. Only they take orders for anything you may want or need. From baby formula to snow tires to high-end electronics, anything at all. They deliver right to your door the very next night at a deep, deep discount. Cash only, and don't ask where it came from. So, of course, the call goes out for help, and here come the drug warriors. They descend upon our neighborhoods, wielding draconian laws, racially biased sentencing, no-knock warrants, and warrantless searches, mandatory minimum sentencing, and zero tolerance. These are weapons of mass destruction that erode the constitutional protections of all Americans, black and white. But when the smoke clears, we find that the collateral damage includes thousands of children living in foster care. 1/4 of all young black men in prison or on parole. In some cities, the figure is over 50%. An epidemic of diseases like AIDS and hepatitis from the two surest vectors, shared needles and prisons. Ever-increasing poverty as felony convictions render more and more young black men unemployed and permanently unemployable, and disenfranchised from the political system in states that strip them forever of their right to vote. The child, caught with a small amount of drugs in his possession, gets the whole family put out of public housing. The family car is forfeit, and he or she is forever barred from the educational grants that might have been used to help turn that young life around. And all for naught, as the crime and killing continue unabated. It's the cure that kills the patient. It's the madness in reefer madness. It's drug prohibition, and it's time we end it. For the Drug Truth Network, this is Phil Jackson.
It's great to have the talents of Mr. Phil Jackson on with us here on Cultural Baggage. Thank you for that, Phil. Okay, some notes, program notes. If your station is interested in picking up or adding either Cultural Baggage or the Century of Lies or even the 420 Drug War News reports, please advise. My only pay is in adding your station to my affiliates list, so please let me know if you join up. Friday, April 29th from 7 to 7:30 p.m., our guest on Cultural Baggage, and it's new time slot will be Dr. Robert Melamed to discuss the various uses of medical marijuana. And then following that, same day, Friday, April 29, 7:30 to 8 p.m., our guest on the first ever Century of Lies will be Jack Cole, Director of Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. Their website, www.leap.cc. And both Cultural Baggage and Century of Lies will henceforward be posted by Saturday mornings on our website, www.drugtruth.net and at audioport.org. The seven daily 420s are always posted by Monday a.m. for use through Monday through Sunday. I want to thank all those affiliates out there. It gives me great pride to know that from Alaska to Hawaii, from Gallup to Galveston, and many other locales throughout the United States, you're hearing these words of these congressmen, judges, scientists, doctors, lawyers, people who understand this drug war, people who have been in the trenches, people who are willing to talk about it. And that's one of those new segments, Saul Turns to Paul, because many of these people have been drug warriors and found that they want to make amends for those hundreds and hundreds of people that they threw in prison or that they banged the gavel on and sent to prison. Let's see. Next week, our guest will... we've been through that. I'm sorry, folks. I'm a little frazzled today, as you can probably understand. I apologize for that. I want you all to pick up the burden, help change these laws, bring it to where we no longer put our children in prison for carrying around little baggies of powders and potions and plants. It's time for the end of, the era of witchcraft. It's got to end. And as always, I remind you, because of drug prohibition, you don't know what's in that bag. Please be careful.
For the Drug Truth Network and our affiliates in the U.S. and Canada, this is Dean Becker for Cultural Baggage, the unvarnished truth. This show is produced at the Pacifica Studios of KPFT, Houston. Jap dancing on the edge of cannabis.